Welcome to The Connection, where humans and aliens converse, and where all the dots are connected. I'm Nancy of Zeta Talk, an emissary for aliens from Zeta Reticuli. They are here to warn of great cataclysms on Earth and advise how to survive this. The pending pole shift is not the end. Man will make his next leap forward to live a better time when aliens will live among us. The Zetas, and only the Zetas, have described the orbit of Planet X as a sling orbit. Planet X is a rogue planet that slings through our solar system every 3,657 years or so. This makes it a planet of our solar system, but one only appearing in ancient records because it seems to disappear into space between passages. Why does it sling and not go round and round like Earth and the other planets? Coming out of the Big Bang, when the suns and the planets were forming and clumping, Planet X started this sling orbit by going around two suns. It slings back and forth past them like a pendulum, and it cannot stop this pattern once started. Two suns? We know our sun is one of them, but what's the other one? Most suns are binaries, dancing around each other in a perpetual dance, but our sun appears to be a singular sun. This is only because its binary, the second sun of the pair, never lit, and thus is a dark hunk out in space. We do not see it. Our sun and its binary pair also do not have a frenetic dance, but are stationary, which may be one reason the sling orbit of Planet X was able to set in place. Using the terminology of astronomers, because of the many debates done on the Sciastro Usenet boards, the suns are called the focus of the orbit, or foci, when more than one. And I quote from Zeta Talk, Second Foci, written October 1995. The sun and the dark star that is the second foci of Planet X's orbit do not rotate around each other any more than the planets in your solar system rotate around each other. The reason for the latter is that the sun dominates the planets, and their influence on each other becomes the lesser voice. In like manner, your sun and this dark star, of a comparable size, are caught in a larger net and are essentially motionless within your galaxy. This net exists for all the stars in your galaxy, as elsewhere, and is the reason the stars in the sky do not lose their position and float toward each other. It's not that they are so far apart that they do not influence each other. Influence, however slight, is always there. It's rather that influence has been balanced to where an equilibrium is reached. To you, who see that distance is maintained, it looks like lack of influence. It's balanced influence. Were you to have seen your galaxy born, clumping into masses with these masses first attracted to and then to some degree repulsed by each other, motion initiated as a result of these opposing forces, you would intuitively understand that large bodies that cease motion do so not because there was no influence upon them, and not because they were not at one time in motion, but because they came to a situation where they essentially are in a dither. The influences upon them are balanced. This second foci of Planet X has not been located by your astronomers because it's dark, not lit, and does not happen to block any view your astronomers are particularly interested in. They think it empty space. Unlike the sun, this dark twin never lit. Although comparable in size and mass, its composition was subtly different, and it has no potential for becoming a lit sun under the present conditions in your part of the universe. It has no planets of any size to mention, although it is orbited by a lot of trash. Should one wish to search for it, it stands at an angle of 11 degrees off the Earth's orbital plane around the sun, in the same direction we have given for the approach of Planet X. not being a luminous body, and not giving off any radiation detectable by human devices, you would be unable to locate it, but this does not mean that it's not there. Do you, like a child with his hands over his eyes, think that you cannot see something that does not exist? End of the quote from Zeta Talk. In fact, this second foci, the binary twin of our sun, gives evidence that it is there, pulling as a gravity center, as our outer planets lean in that direction. And 13 long-period comets also pull in that direction. Obviously, something besides Planet X, which is just another planet, is out there. This is the reason NASA and JPL went looking in that direction in the early 1980s. This subject came up during the PsiAstro debates in 1998, during a debate with Jim Scotti, who is an astronomer well-known, in fact, who works out of the Tucson Observatory, famously known as the Pope Scope, because the Pope buys time there to peer into the southern skies, looking for Planet X. Naturally, Jim denies that anyone was looking for the sun's binary twin, or that during the search they discovered Planet X as a rogue planet slinging past both suns in its pendulum orbit. And I quote from the PsiAstro Usenet postings, an article dated April 1, 1998. Jim Scotti writes, "Now, who was frantically searching for Planet X in the 1980s? And the Zetas replied, "You were, among others. What does it take to get articles published in magazines like Newsweek and Astronomy and on the front page of the Washington Post? A nap?" And then I list the magazines and article titles. Astronomy Magazine, December 81, an article titled "Search for the Tenth Planet." Astronomy Magazine, October 82, article titled "Searching for a Tenth Planet." Newsweek, dated June 28, 1982, article titled "Does the Sun Have a Dark Companion?" U.S. News World Report, dated September 10, 1984, article titled "Planet X, Is It Really Out There?" And Washington Post, December 31, 1983, a front page story titled "Mystery Heavenly Body Discovered." Jim Scotti comes back a couple days later with the reply, "All these articles discuss the possibility of a new planet, and maybe even some unconfirmed reports, but they're not scientific proof that there was a planet found or that there is a cover-up." And then I quote from some of these various magazine articles in the early 1980s. Astronomy Magazine, December 81st, discussion on Planet X. "Tiny Pluto is 100 to 1,000 times too small to fully account for Uranus wobble, according to Tom Van Flandern of the U.S. Naval Observatory." And from Astronomy Magazine, October 82, discussion on Planet X on page 62. "Both Uranus and Neptune follow irregular paths that observers can explain only by assuming the presence of an unknown body whose gravity tugs at the two planets. Astronomers originally thought Pluto might be the body perturbing its neighbors, but the combined mass of Pluto and its moon Charon is too small for such a role." And from Newsweek magazine, June 28, 1982, a short article on page 83. "A dark companion could produce the unseen force that seems to tug at Uranus and Neptune, speeding them up at one point in their orbits and holding them back as they pass. The best bet is a dark star orbiting at least 50 million miles beyond Pluto, which is 3.6 billion miles from the Sun. It's most likely either a brown dwarf, a lightweight star that never attained the critical mass needed to ignite, or else a neutron star, the remnants of a normal sun that burned out and collapsed. The companion star would tug at the outer planets, not just Uranus and Neptune," says Tom Van Flandern of the U.S. Naval Observatory. These articles switched their focus after the 1983 discovery of Planet X approaching our solar system from the direction of that dark, unlit sun. They were no longer searching for the binary twin of the sun, the gravity force, but on the approaching monster planet, a planet on the move and coming our way. And I quote from the Washington Post, December 31st, 1983, a front page story, Mystery Heavenly Body Discovered. A heavenly body possibly as large as the giant planet Jupiter, and possibly so close to Earth that it would be part of our solar system, has been found in the direction of the constellation Orion by an orbiting telescope aboard the U.S. Infrared Astronomical Satellite. And from U.S. News Report, September 10, 1984, article on page 74. Shrouded from the sun's light, mysteriously tugging at the orbits of Uranus and Neptune, is an unseen force that astronomers suspect may be Planet X, a tenth resident of the Earth's celestial neighborhood. Last year, the Infrared Astronomical Satellite, IRAS, circled in a polar orbit 560 miles from the Earth, detected heat from an object about 50 billion miles away that is now the subject of intense speculation. Sling orbits, such as the one Planet X assumes, are not unheard of, but are described as a long elliptical orbit when NASA finds one of them. And I quote from an article called New Rebel Planet Found Outside Solar System. Its roller coaster orbit stuns scientists. Dated October 23, 1998. A new planet that breaks all the rules about how and where planets form has been identified in orbit of a twin star around 70 light years from Earth in a constellation commonly known as the Northern Cross. The new planet has a roller coaster-like orbit that swoops down close to its central star and then swings far out into frigid fringes, following a strange egg-shaped orbit that is unlike that of any other known planet. End of the quote. So having the orbits of planets affected by more than one gravity center, more than one foci or sun, is not unheard of. The Zetas say that this second foci, the binary twin of our sun, stands 18.74 Sun-Pluto distances away. Not that far away when you think of it, right in the neighborhood. So why does it take so long, 3,657 years, for Planet X to sling past that dark binary sun and return, like a pendulum swinging back and forth? Because when it gets in the center, it dithers. And I quote from Zeta Talk, Comet Orbit, written August 1995. The path of Planet X is elliptical, making a long, flat circle around its two gravitational masters, your sun and a body you cannot see. The sun's alter ego in this matter is not an object on your sky maps, but for the purposes of calculating the orbit of Planet X, you can assume it to have the same mass as the sun and to be at a distance that allows the curve of the ellipse to smooth to an essentially straight line between the two orbital foci. The travels of Planet X are not unlike a train on parallel tracks, where the train is on one side of the tracks going in one direction and on the other side coming back. It will surprise you to know that the second foci is not that far away. Since it rivals the sun in mass, the assumption would be that your astronomers would know about it. However, being dark, they stare past it and think it's space. To use multiples of the distance from your sun to its farthest known orbiting planet, which you call Pluto, this foci is from the sun 18.724 times as far away. The elliptical path of Planet X does little direct damage to the planets in your solar system, which are lined up on a plane with each other. Planet X comes in on an angle, such that it's only the point of passage where a direct collision would occur. This point, at the present time, is not in the orbital path of any of your solar system planets, although that was not the case in the distant past, as your asteroid belt attests. For this pole shift, we estimate that the Earth will be on the same side as Planet X, at approximately an 18-degree angle from where Planet X comes closest to the Sun. Its return is on the other side of the Sun. On the return voyage, during this passage, the Earth will be protected by the Sun from a full impact, but mild earthquakes and heavy tides will recur at that time. Having passed by the Sun, Planet X now slows. The rate of slowing is dependent on two factors, essentially, its speed and the fact that both its gravitational masters are now behind it. As fast as the 12th planet picked up speed approaching your sun, it slows even faster. The nearness of your sun behind it, no small factor in this. Nevertheless, for a traveling planet the size of Planet X, putting on the brakes and returning about is no small matter. It must first come to a stop, which it does in approximately 2 years, 3 months after passing your sun. The orbit of Planet X takes it well away from the sun after passage, so that it moves out a distance equal to one quarter of the distance between the sun and its other foci before it slows to a stop. After passing through the solar system, Planet X moves out on the opposite side some 3.560 times the distance from your sun to its farthest planet, Pluto, then stops. It then hovers, not moving essentially, for 3 years, 6 months, and then slowly begins a return trip which telescopes or mirrors the voyage out. End of the quote from Zeta Talk. Since the Zeta message about the return of Planet X is one that threatens the hold the establishment has on the populace, and they fear panic erupting if the populace learns that the government they are paying taxes to will not protect them or support them when a pole shift happens. This description of the sling orbit came under ridicule and rejection during the Psi-Astro debates. Under ridicule was the speed with which Planet X would have to travel, coming toward the solar system from its dither point between the two suns. And I quote from some Psi-Astro postings dated April 1, 1998. Subject was Planet X and the 12th Planet Long Elliptical Orbit. Jim Scotty writes, "I hate to be the bearer of bad news again, Nancy, but if your Planet X is beyond 40 astronomical units out, then it can't get here as early or as soon as I heard you say in a recent post. Assuming it's coming in on a long elliptical orbit, as you say, and is still 40 astronomical units out, then it will be 20 years before it arrives. If it's even further out, say at 100 astronomical units, then it will arrive in 76 years. Obviously, we'd see such an object with plenty of parallax." And the Zetas replied, "On what basis do you make this statement? The current sedate rate that your familiar planets take? Slowly circling the sun, always within their balanced range from the sun? You have before you a recent discovery of a planet on a long elliptical orbit that your science cannot explain, but you still insist on asserting that your math explains all. Such is the arrogance of human astronomy." Not able to counter the Zeta argument except with an insult, Jim says, "You don't understand the concept and the working of an elliptical orbit." "Ah, but two can play at that game," the Zetas reply. And they say, "Nor do you. You put into your equations only what you've seen, or what they present back to you is likely to occur based on what you've seen. When you come upon something that you've not seen before, then you recompute and get smug again. Smug is hardly the word, and arrogant is still too mild for the behavior of elite astronomers who have just recently had egg on their face regarding their reversal on comet 1997-XF11. You don't ever make mistakes? You don't ever have to scratch your heads and go back to square one? What about the recent discovery that the universe was not expanding more rapidly than supposed? Supposed is the operant word here, as this is what you do. When you find your previous suppositions don't fit, you tweak the math until it fits the new observation and then proclaim you know all. And when some things don't fit into the equation, you toss them out entirely." Retreating to the argument that human physics and math is sound, Jim states, "Science can easily explain these planets on long elliptical orbits. It's only the details of how things work that have perhaps not been worked out yet, but the laws of physics are not so easily dismissed." And the Zetas reply, "How can you make a pronouncement that our statement on the orbit of Planet X is utterly wrong, and in the next breath admit that you cannot explain the orbits of two bodies recently discovered? You've just made our point for us.
Well, thank you.
Continuing the Psi-Astro debate, Jim brings up the human astrophysics understanding that an orbit always goes around one foci, not two, and this foci is neither of the suns when there are two foci, but a point out in space between the suns, out there, an imaginary point out there in space. And quoting from some Psi-Astro postings dated April 3, 1998, still that thread about Planet X and the 12th planet's long elliptical orbit, Jim Scotti writes, "If it's to be here in 2003, then it can't be any further out than about 20 astronomical units, unless, of course, it's not bound to our solar system, but then it's not on a long elliptical orbit." Once again, you've not learned what Johannes Kepler was able to figure out about 400 years ago about the motion of objects around our sun on elliptical orbits. You don't understand the concept and the workings of an elliptical orbit. The central body occupies only one of the two foci. The other is empty and has no effect on the motion of your planet X. When it's near the other focus, it will be moving at its slowest, not zipping. And the Zetas reply, "How could that be logically? If you can't explain why an elliptical orbit is assumed, you place an imaginary body at a point in space to fit the math? It fits the equations of your gods of physics, who must be worshipped apparently at all costs. If the math of orbits was worked out centuries ago, based on what they knew and had observed, then this same math must be applied? Is that logical? You're making the broad assumption that a body cannot orbit two foci. Why not? If all you've seen are objects lopping far out of their orbits around a single foci, then is this all there is? It's a fact that most suns are binaries, and some so close as to give the appearance of barely keeping each other at arm's length. Why should it be astonishing that a planet would institute an orbit around both? Clearly, some of the highly elliptical orbits recently discovered by your fellows show that orbiting bodies, much larger than dirty snowballs, are influenced by something out there pulling on them. Are you saying it's impossible for a planet to orbit two suns? Impossible?" Then we get a concession from Jim. A planet can orbit both suns in a binary star system. The Zetas went to press their advantage. They say, "You went through an elaborate statement to say you base your theories on orbits upon what you observed. Inverse square on gravity and momentum conservation of energy rules. Bearing in mind that you have not observed a planet orbiting two suns, both suns in a binary system, what would that orbit look like? For the sake of moving this argument forward, we'll assume for the moment that your orbital mechanics are correct and not under challenge. Just paint for us what the orbit would look like. Not the several pages of math, but just something simple in the manner you're so very skilled at employing. A simple verbal description of what such an object would look like. You have a head start in that your astronomy computer programs already assume a second foci in an elliptical orbit. Just put that foci out there, way out there, some 18.724 times as far as Pluto is from your sun. Assume the same factors published prior to the search for Planet X. Van Flanders' statement that the perturbations observed in the outer planets would require a planet or brown dwarf 2 to 5 times as large as Earth. We are requesting for this discussion that you assume a planet 4 times as large as Earth, as this is our statement. Grant us this assumption in return for our granting that your assumption on orbital mechanics is correct, tit for tat, one concession for another. And since both assumptions are based on human assumptions, you should have no objection. This hypothetical discussion would be no different from any other occurring on Psi-Astro in that regard, applying known physics, as you say, to a hypothetical situation. What would such an orbit where a planet orbited both suns in a binary system look like?" But at this point, forced to discuss the swing orbit the Zetas have described for Planet X, the one going around two binary suns, 18.74 sun-Pluto distances from each other, Jim stops the debate and does not return. This was April 6, 1998, so on April 10th, the Zetas gave a nudge. But the debate was now one-sided, Jim having left the floor. And I quote from the PsyAstro posting dated April 10th. This was titled, Challenge to Jim Scotti, so he wouldn't miss it. We will note you are avoiding an exercise we asked you to take, one that should be a piece of cake for you, Jim, as your computer programs are set up to support this. We asked a week ago, following your confirmation of our statement that a planet could orbit both suns in a binary system, what such an orbit would look like, given the distance that we have and the mass of this planet. Are you holding back because the results would confirm our description? Well, the debate was over, but I consider this just another example of Zetas right again. The issue of what would cause a sling orbit came up repeatedly, since all known orbits are round and round. For the Zetas, it's having two gravity pulls behind it when the pendulum swings to a far side that causes Planet X to turn around and come back. And it is momentum that causes it to travel from one sun to another. And I quote from Zeta Talk, Sling Orbit, written during the 2001 PsyAstro debates. There is confusion in understanding the nature of a Planet X eccentric orbit and the effect it and your sun's dark binary twin have, because man is struggling to reconcile this new information with existing astrophysics theories and the math formulas used to describe them. Somehow they must all fit, and they don't. The problem lies with the theories and formulas, though few throw them aside, as then they feel adrift, without an anchor. The insecure slam shut the doors, close out new information, and develop the closed-minded syndrome recently under discussion here on PsyAstro. For those not closed-minded, we will describe the eccentric orbit of Planet X between your sun and its dark twin. This unlit binary sun lies some 18.74 times the distance from your sun to Pluto, at 11-degree angle from the ecliptic, in the direction of the constellation of Orion. Though farther away, twice the distance or more, from where Planet X rides at the moment, it's a large gravitational giant, and thus between these two binaries, Planet X is caught in a highly elliptical orbit. This orbit does not fit into man's astrophysics theory, and thus cannot be described by the math used by man to describe comet or orbit behavior. Yet the orbit makes sense if one puts the dictates of man's current theories aside. There is a desktop toy composed of several metal balls hung in a line from a wooden frame, which when set in motion causes the balls to swing out, then return to bump all the balls in the row until the ball on the opposite end swings out in an equal manner, hence continuing until gravity wears the motion down to a stop. This toy is a simple example that an object will stop when escaping a gravity pull and return toward that gravity pull by reversing its course. The back-and-forth sling is a return trip, as the toy demonstrates. The difference between Planet X and the desktop toy is that the toy had its major gravity pull in the center, bringing the motion to a stop, where Planet X has its dual gravitational pulls at the ends of its sling orbit, which keeps the slinging motion going. End of the quote from Zetatalk. Naturally, the sling orbit described was discounted by those debating the Zetas on PsyAstro in 1998. The argument was that such an orbit and the speed required during passage of any one of its suns would sling it so far out in the solar system that it would never return. Planet X would just keep on going. A term used to describe this in astrophysics is escape velocity. And a quote from a PsyAstro posting titled, Planet X / 12th Planet, Distance at Present, dated April 9, 1998. A fellow writes, the escape velocity of the sun is 670 kilometers per second. Therefore, it's impossible for this imaginary object to be on an elliptical orbit around the sun. It would be moving too fast. The orbit would have to be hyperbolic, and the object cannot return to the solar system. And the Zetas reply, impossible? You stated with smug assurance the age of the universe a year ago, and now an impossible date has been hurriedly calculated to take into account some new information based on observations. My, my, it's impossible only until it is demonstrated not to be impossible. Sound traveling silently through the air as it passes between a ball held in front of one man and arrives into a box in front of another? Impossible until radio waves become commonplace. You're a fool to use that word. You diminish yourself, as we know you're no fool. The odd factor giving you fits is your stupid escape velocity factor, in which you imagine that speed is what allows an object to exit the solar system, and this speed is a constant, the cause. The silly conservation of motion rules that no longer fit into your equations, but you still cling to it. Speed is a factor of attraction and repulsion, not a constant that rules. Jim Scotty came to the rescue at this point, being the senior astronomer and all, touting mankind's accomplishments. On April 10, 1998, he states, 400 years of observation and calculation has shown that gravity and elliptical orbits, along with parabolic and hyperbolic orbits, go hand in hand. The detailed derivation of such can be found in any celestial mechanics textbooks, such as Danby's Fundamentals of Celestial Mechanics. We've accurately predicted the last four returns of Comet Halley and hundreds of its short-period comet cousins, along with all the planets, asteroids, and most recently have sent man-made spacecraft to the moon and planets using exactly this theory of gravity. And the Zetas replied, "You are replacing an explanation with a description. We've made this statement perhaps hundreds of times on this Usenet. Your posture is no different from a two-year-old stating the Earth is flat and the Sun revolves around it because he observes this and can predict this will be the case the next day, or when he walks to the horizon and still sees the horizon flat before him. Would you allow this to stand? You'd say, in a superior and smug way, that he would have to place his childish theories up against what you have observed and reconcile them. Well, we're asking little Jim to do the same." And Jim Scotty replies, "We've successfully predicted the return of Halley's Comet since Sir Edmund Halley himself predicted the 1758 return." And the Zetas state, "The two-year-old with the flat Earth theory again, the Earth the center of the universe theory, could point to some 700 repeated recurrences. Does that make him right? Does his theory and observation line up with other known facts? Per the Zetas, what causes Planet X to return around at the end of its pendulum swing and return is that the Sun's gravity pull is the strongest force in the vicinity. The Zetas point out, since there is no friction in space, that speed for such a traveling planet in a sling orbit can be much more than mankind assumes." And I quote from Zeta Talk, Escape Velocity, written during the 2001 Sci-Astro debates. "Mankind is not oriented with how fast objects can travel in space. They're held to the concept of speed on the surface of Earth, where friction is a factor. When traveling on the surface, there is drag from the atmosphere or from water, so there's a finite speed attainable. When traveling the surface, an object is fighting gravity, a struggle. And when trying to get to Mars or the other planets for a peak, a probe is propelled by jets and a limited amount of fuel, so does not attain speed. But in all these cases, there is either friction or drag, or a lack of impetus. Mankind sees the planets floating about in their orbits and thinks this is the speed that planets attain. But space does not offer friction or drag, so this element is utterly missing. And when there are large objects gravitationally attracted to each other, no jets or fuel supplies need be a limiting factor. Thus, we're approaching the Sun in a direct line that has not had the repulsion force invoked as yet. Planet X has no brakes. How fast is fast? During the passage, it has not achieved the maximum speed that such a traveling world might. It has just started to step on the gas." End of the quote from Zeta Talk. "During its rapid approach into the solar system, Planet X assumed a speed close to the speed of light." And I quote from Zeta Talk, Speed, written also during the 2001 Sci-Astro debates. "Speed in space is a relative thing. Your submarines move more slowly than your cars. because they deal with less drag. Likewise, objects shot into space or incoming feel little distress when out where the atmosphere is negligible, and tend to heat up and burn when in the thick of the Earth's atmosphere. Thus, objects in space have no ill effects from a high speed other than what they might encounter. In the dozen or so years prior to a passage, Planet X speeds up from an almost standstill to a zoom toward the foci it is approaching. Imagine the Earth without atmosphere and a rock some miles overhead. What's the speed limit on this rock as it plummets? There is no limit in space, only that which mankind assumes. During mass discussions on Sciastro, it has been surmised that the speed of Planet X approaches the speed of light during its most rapid approach, and this astonishes those in the discussion. Why is it assumed that light is the fastest thing in the universe? Ray travel. Man thinks this because it is something he can measure. He is aware of such a small percentage of matter and energy about him that to say that he comprehends 1% of what the universe is composed of would be an overstatement. Our space travel is faster than light, and we do not melt. Man does not understand, so we cannot give him satisfaction in our explanations. End of the quote from Zeta 12. Planet X zooms into the solar system and then slows as it nears the sun, dramatically so. Why? Because of the repulsion force and anti-gravity force, which is in essence gravity particles blowing out from a gravity sink. Gravity particles drift toward the sun, pulling the planets toward the sun. But when there is an accumulation inside the sun, they burst forth outward in a laser-type outburst. The drifting toward the gravity sink, the sun, most affects the planets being kept as satellites around the sun, because it's a steady pull, whereas the laser outburst is sudden and quick. Overall, the pull toward the sun is present more often and prevails as the dominant gravity factor. And I quote from Zeta Talk, Speed, written during the 2001 Sciastro debates. Planet X is, of course, drawn by the gravity pull of the sun and thus its periodic passage, but it's also pushed away by the gravity particle streams emitted by the sun, which can be described as a fire hose of force, meeting the fire hose of force from Planet X itself. They buffer away from each other, forcing the speeding Planet X to bypass the sun at a distance based on its mass and the mass of the sun. The reducing mass of the sun explains why Planet X is coming closer during its passage at the present time than its past passages, which were through the asteroid belt. Were Planet X to encounter a small object, such as occurred in the asteroid belt in the past, it would either be treated like a meteor or, if large enough, become a moon satellite of Planet X, as many objects have. The pelting to pieces that occurred in the asteroid belt was due to collisions of objects not of significant size enough to invoke the repulsion force. Small planets, passing close to Planet X during its high-speed passage, might become a satellite moon or be pelted to pieces by one of Planet X's trailing moons, except in the heavily crowded asteroid belt, which contains some 24 planets and various moons of same prior to past passages. End of the quote from Zeta Talk. But we're zooming through the asteroid belt. Planet X slows dramatically when it reaches the sun due to the intense hosing of gravity particles known as the repulsion force. But there are other slowing influences, such as particle flows moving out of the sun at its middle. Per the Zetas, it is a crowded ecliptic, and as Planet X is trying to pierce the ecliptic, coming through the solar system at a slight angle from the south to the north, Planet X is plowing through a headwind. And I quote from Zeta Talk, Slowing Influences, written May 2002. When moving from the midpoint from its orbit between its two foci, the Sun and its dark twin some 18.74 Sun-Pluto distances away, the speed of passage is, at first, slow as the gravity particles pulling it toward the Sun are scarcely more than the gravity particles pulling it toward the dark binary twin. Exponentially faster, as the gravity particles increase at this rate, the closer Planet X gets to the Sun. Without impediment when afar from the solar system, as represented by the planets orbiting the Sun alone, increasing in essence at an exponential speed when approaching this solar system complex, decreasing dramatically at about the orbit of Mars by the braking action of the repulsion force, at last strong enough to counter the inbound plunge towards the Sun, slow to a floating rate so that it floats past the Earth during the week of rotation stoppage, which is the point where it is also floating past the Sun rather than zooming past, and an increase in speed to leave the inner solar system as the laser blasts of gravity particles coming from the Sun, adding to the momentum past the Sun already in place, combine to speed it on its way. End of the quote from Zeta Talk. Many of these concepts, the repulsion force and the crowded ecliptic, came under ridicule when presented on the PsiAstro Usenet board in 1998. The repulsion force is what holds the Moon up there, as it's way too large and moving way too slowly to be held up there by centrifugal force. Remember as a child holding an object at the end of a string, going round and round and keeping it aloft? Remember how fast you had to be going to keep it aloft? The discussion on PsiAstro started with I, Nancy, suggesting we replace the nebulous term mass in two equations that describe where the Moon is and why it stays up there with weight, the weight of granite. After all, the Moon does not have a molten core and is rock. The two equations were the inverse square law, which more or less describes that the closer an object gets to a gravity draw, the stronger that gravity pull becomes. And second, Newton's law, which describes how fast an object must be orbiting another to stay aloft. During the debate, I, Nancy, was rescued by a couple mathematicians who took over the computations, so this was, in essence, their math. This posting on the Usenet board was titled Challenge to Jim Scotti and dated May 22, 1998. This was my challenge to the astronomers on PsiAstro. So what you're saying is that if you calculate the mass by placing it opposite your orbital mechanics equations, and then you point to the way these balance, the numbers on the left and the right-hand side of the equal sign, and crow about how accurate your math is. Try plugging in a real estimate of the weight of the Moon, solid rock, with X radius, at what numbers do you come up with? You have a monster Moon up there drifting slowly around its gravitational attraction. Intuitively, it seems it should be dropping to Earth and not losing any time doing so. If you use real numbers for its mass, your orbital mechanics goes out the window, does it not? Well, the Zetas got in on the issue also and stated, "Per your fellow, the force of gravity is equal to the force between two objects, and one must take them both into consideration. Take the weight of a square foot of granite on the surface of your Earth and use that as a constant for mass, as some constant must exist. Calculate the weight, then, of the Earth, and likewise the Moon, and thus produce F, the force of gravity, between them in a manner the common man can relate to. Two masses of solid granite, or nearly so, pulling toward each other." The mass computations covered the diameter of the Earth and the Moon, the volume of a sphere, thence the volume of the Earth and the Moon, the weight of granite, the computed metric tons for Earth and the Moon, the gravity pull for inverse square law, using the weight of these two objects, the Earth and the Moon, and the distance between them, and the orbital speed of the Moon. The Britannica states the supersonic speed that the Concorde flies at when breaking the sound barrier to be 1,200 miles per hour or 533.33 meters per second. Stationary satellites must travel 4,635 meters per second to stay aloft. So the Moon is traveling at the rate of a Concorde while weighing the equivalent of 23 million trillion tons. Note the weight of the Moon has been adjusted down from its actual weight if it were on the surface of the Earth, reduced because it's at a distance. The Earth thinks, gravity-wise, that the Moon weighs 23 million trillion tons, as though it were riding just off the surface of the Earth and moving much slower than a satellite would have to move to stay aloft. Does this make sense? It's not centrifugal force keeping that huge, heavy moon up there. It's the repulsion force as described by the Zetas. So the Zetas replied on June 5, 1998. Your astronomers, unable to bring all their equations and physics together on one page, are telling you that your moon, at an adjusted weight of 23 million trillion metric tons, could cruise along at one quarter the speed of your stationary satellites, or only twice the speed of your Concorde jets, and maintain its place due to centrifugal force. The theater of the absurd is about to open. But this was defended, despite the evidence that mankind's two precious math formulas, the inverse square law and Newton's law for orbiting objects, could not be put together on the same page and make sense when real quantities were substituted for the abstract of mass. So where are we now? In 2003, Planet X did indeed zoom into the solar system, roaring up to the sun, and was seen from Earth during the summer of 2003. Earth was on the opposite side of this drama, and the sunlight bouncing off the dust cloud shrouding Planet X created dramatic second sun sightings during that summer. Then it slowed, crept past the south pole of the sun, and is close to the ecliptic now, fighting the particle flows, coming back toward the sun, fighting this headwind. And I quote from Zeta Talk, Dead On and Deadly, written April 3, 2006. Since the Earth encountered Planet X in her orbit on December 25, 2003, her orbit has stalled as she encountered an elephant in the road at this point and could not pass. Planet X had been plunging toward the sun, rapidly entering the solar system in the short years prior to 2003, at a speed close to the speed of light. As Planet X approached the sun in early 2003, brilliant second sun sightings and photos were possible, because the Earth was on the opposite side of the sun from the approaching Planet X, and thus sunlight was reflected off the dust cloud and bounced back toward Earth. Then came the encounter with Planet X in Earth's orbit, and things changed. As Planet X was moving, still, toward the sun, sunlight now was at its back, bouncing back toward the sun, and visibility of this dust-shrouded planet changed from brilliant and dramatic second sun sightings to puzzlement. Like an object in a fog bank, it was lost to view except for those times when its swirling tail and moons caught sunlight and deflected this to Earth. Evidence of the presence of Planet X in the inner solar system, slowly passing the south pole of the sun, was reduced to taking the pulse of Earth herself. Increased earthquakes, volcanic activity, an earth wobble evident to those astute enough to take note, and erratic weather accompanying the wobble. The eddy flow created by particles flowing from the sun and thence around the sides of Planet X trapped Earth in her stalled orbit and held her there in front of Planet X, no escape. As Planet X proceeded past the sun's south pole in its sling orbit, he went within the orbit of Venus and thus likewise trapped Venus in this eddy flow cup when she came round in her orbit to encounter Planet X. The Earth's dark twin, sharing an orbit with Earth, joined this group of trapped planets within months, remaining behind the Earth, likewise stalled in their shared orbit, a dark hunk of black rock reflecting little light and thus essentially invisible to man. This has been the setup throughout 2004 and into 2005, a rapid plunge of Planet X toward the sun countered by the repulsion force into a slow creep past the sun. This is not a static condition, however, caught in the eddy flow cup. Venus and Earth and her dark twin are pushed backwards in their orbits as Planet X progresses in its retrograde sling past the sun. For those who would think that this would result in horrific trauma on Earth, we point to what causes orbits in the first place, the gentle nudge from the sweeping arms of the sun causing all the planets in the solar system to move in the same direction, counterclockwise, around the sun. Orbits are not sacred. They are composed of planets bobbling in particle flows and nudged into momentum when these particle flows have force and direction. Orbits can move in one direction or another without impact on the planets, which are passive during this process. We've described the point where Planet X pierces the ecliptic, moving from alignment with the sun's magnetic field, where the lines go into the sun's south pole, to alignment with the magnetic field where the lines come out from the sun's north pole, as a time of a 270-degree roll for planet S. It turns in place 180 degrees to point its north pole away from the sun's south pole, then stands upright at the ecliptic, and later does another 270-degree roll while adjusting to the magnetic flow lines coming out from the sun's north pole. Lately, it has been noted that Planet X appears slightly to the right of the Sun when sighted or captured on film. We explained that during this 270-degree roll, the north pole of Planet X swings around according to the retrograde rotation of Planet X, clockwise, and thus the hose of magnetic particles coming from the north pole of Planet X emerges on the right side. This causes Earth to scuttle even faster backward in her orbit to the left, to escape this hose of magnetic particles. This is where we are today in the spring of 2006. For those who say such maneuvers on Earth would be apparent, announced loudly by astronomers, we point to the many observations that things are not normal and the obvious cover-up against admission that Planet X is in the inner solar system to dampen panic in the populace. Just why do you suppose Bush is frantic to be sitting on all of the world's oil fields at this time, if not that he realizes a pole shift is around the corner? To prevent such panic as might allow Bush to declare martial law, we and other benign aliens tweak the planets and the moon for key events like an eclipse to simulate normalcy and tip the globe to simulate the seasons, giving the appearance of apparent precision in astrophysics. What comes next? Early in the Zeta Talk saga, we described the Zeta Talk triangle, the relationship between the Earth, Sun, and Planet X when Planet X pierces the ecliptic. This Zeta Talk triangle was featured in July 2003 in dual Wisconsin crop circles, a move that was made by ourselves and others in support of a beleaguered Nancy who had suffered through our white lie regarding the May 15, 2003 date. What puzzled many was the placement of Planet X to the right of the Earth, when we likewise had described the pole shift as occurring when Planet X stands between the Earth and Sun, supplanting the Sun's dominance as the largest magnet in the solar system. Based on our more recent description of the 270-degree roll and the Earth scuttling to the left to avoid the hose of magnetic particles, this triangle can be fitted into the larger equation. At the point the ecliptic is pierced, Planet X has pointed its north pole away from the Sun and toward the Earth. Earth reacts by leaning its north pole away into the 3 days of darkness predicted for the northern hemisphere. Prior to this, as the north pole of Planet X is swinging around, the Earth falls on its side, as we have described, the north pole of Earth to the left in the extreme, thence rolling into the 3 days of darkness as Planet X points its north pole directly at Earth. This is a rapid and highly dramatic time for Earth, lasting but days at each stage. But what are the months leading into this drama? Earth scuttles back in her orbit. Planet X is seen to the right of the Sun, and increasingly coming closer and appearing larger and unmistakably, not as a solar flare or sun dog, and the Earth falls to her side little by little. This makes for a lopsided arc of the Sun across the sky during the day, the Sun not where expected, hardly something the pat excuse for the Earth changes, global warming, could accomplish. During this slow 270-degree roll, Planet X is steadfastly moving closer to the Earth, as the diagrams Nancy and friends have constructed show. It not only appears larger in the sky, it has a steady, strong grip on the Atlantic Rift and the poles, creating a stronger and more violent wobble. This equates to stronger quakes and volcanic activity, wilder weather, and the populace starting to question matters in a shrill, not polite, manner. If this is global warming, what's that to the right of the Sun? And why is the Earth falling to her side? We predict the White House will shutter their windows and refuse questions on the matter if they are functioning at all at that time. End of the quote from Zeta Talk. That concludes our broadcast. Thank you for being with us. Remember to carry love in your heart. It's the commodity of the future. As the Zetas say, love may have a blooming going into the shift, as it ought. Those with great love in their hearts responding to the realization that little else matters.